WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest David Margalek has written a new book about the history of one song, a song about lynching made famous by this 1939 Billie Holiday recording.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree. A strange and bitter crop.
Strange Fruit was named the best song of the century by Time magazine. In telling the history of the song, David Margalek's book Strange Fruit tells interconnecting stories about jazz, folk music, cafe society, and the civil rights movement. Margalek is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and former national legal affairs editor for the New York Times. Strange Fruit was composed by Lewis Allen, who also wrote the lyrics, but Lewis Allen was just a pen name.
Lewis Allen's real name was Abel Meeropol. Abel Meeropol was a school teacher in the Bronx in New York City. He was a political activist but basically sort of a compulsive writer of songs and poems and essays. He was a member of the American Communist Party, and he was a passionate believer in social justice who tried to use his compositions to advance the cause.
I think maybe what he's most famous for is being the adopted father of the two sons of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg.
Yes, this came along later, and this was actually one of the reasons that I wanted to get into the project. I mean, I knew of him independently because I was always interested in the Rosenberg case, and I knew that the Rosenbergs had been adopted by a man named Meeropol. Abel Meeropol and his wife, Ann Meeropol, did not actually know the Rosenbergs. But they were childless, and they were sympathizers with the Rosenbergs. They were sort of in the same leftist community in New York. And when the Rosenbergs were executed and the children were orphaned, the Meeropols, who were childless themselves, made efforts to adopt them. And after considerable difficulties, were allowed to adopt the two children. And I think really saved those two children's lives. I mean, they let the children disappear and have reasonably normal childhoods, which was no mean feat.
Who sang the song before Billie Holiday sang it?
It was kind of a staple of the left-wing bungalow colony set in the Catskills. And Lewis Allen and his wife would perform it together. Various other members of their sort of social entourage would do it. another black woman sang it at Madison Square Garden at a rally for the Spanish loyalists during the Spanish Civil War. It was kicking around for several years before Billie Holiday got a hold of it. And the interesting thing about it is that it was a, although there are no earlier recordings of it, it was a very different song. He wrote it in sort of a more jazzy, I guess one can't say upbeat about a song about a lynching, but it was more sort of assertive less sort of languorous than the version that Billie Holiday eventually did. She slowed it down and put her own stamp on it in the way she did with everything that she sang.
How did Billie Holiday first get to sing Strange Fruit?
Billie Holiday was appearing at Cafe Society, which had just opened in Greenwich Village in New York. It's important to understand that Cafe Society was a unique place in the New York firmament in the late 1930s. It was the only integrated nightclub. Nightclubs, even in New York, even the so-called citadel of progressivism, were still segregated places where whites would go up to Harlem, and even in Harlem, whites and blacks would sit in separate places. Cafe Society was a deliberate attempt to get beyond that, and it was a place where progressive people would hang out. It was a place that set out to be very different, and it had just started, and a fellow who had put together one of the shows in which Strange Fruit appeared mentioned it to Barney Josephson, who was the man who was the impresario behind Cafe Society. And one day, they must have encouraged Abel Mirapol to come in and perform the song for Billie Holiday to see if she'd be interested in it. And so he came in and sat down at the piano and played it for her. And that's how it was brought to her attention.
The story gets complicated here because there's a lot of different versions of who actually played a part in writing the song and how Billie Holiday felt about the song. She takes some of the songwriting credit in her autobiography, which was co-written with William Dufty. She says that Mirapol showed her the song and he suggested that her pianist, Sonny White, and she turn it into music. It's a little ambiguous about whether she means make it sound more musical or write a melody.
Yeah, it is a little bit ambiguous. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that Abel Mirapol wrote the lyrics to the song and wrote a tune to set those lyrics to. I think the ambiguity comes in partly because, as I said, Billie Holiday put her stamp on everything, you know, she clearly changed the song around and changed the whole feeling of the song to suit her temperament and her attitude towards it. And I think that therein may lie some of the ambiguity. I think that she may have felt that the version that she ended up singing sounded very little like the one that he wrote. But that's not the way that he felt. I mean, he was there when she first performed it. He said that she made it sound that it was exactly what he had in mind. And he spent the rest of his life really trying to clear up this ambiguity and to insist that the composition was his and his alone.
In her Jazz at the Philharmonic recording of Strange Fruit, she says, "This is a song that was written for me."
Yeah, again, that's, you know, it's part of the sort of revisionist history that that she adopted. It's not so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Margalek, and his new book traces the history of the recording Strange Fruit. It's called Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday, Cafe Society, and an Early Cry for Civil Rights. Columbia, her record company of the time, didn't record Strange Fruit. She recorded it instead on a small label, Commodore Records. Why did she take it to Commodore?
Well, she took it to Commodore because no other major house would have done it. I mean, Columbia had already turned it down. And she must have known of Commodore. She hung out at the Commodore record store, which was actually on 42nd Street near Grand Central Station. Commodore was run by a guy named Milt Gabler. And he was a left-wing type, you know, a progressive type who did this kind of, who recorded a few songs on the side, apart from selling records. And he was somebody who was sympathetic with the message of this song, and put it out with very little fear or fanfare, just got it out there. And so she went to him. She recorded four sides that day. They sat down in the studio and sort of wrote out Fine and Mellow on the spot. Fine and Mellow, which is really one of her most, one of the other very famous songs that she's done. And that was on the flip side. And they recorded these four songs that day.
Yeah, Fine and Mellow, which was, I guess, meant to be the B-side, was really the hit side, wasn't it, of Strange Fruit?
You know, I've never really gotten an answer to that. I don't know. I think that each side had its own constituency. And I don't know, you know, I think people, it was a peculiar thing. It was sort of a schizophrenic record, and people bought it for different reasons.
So how much airplay did Strange Fruit get after it was recorded?
It got very little airplay for many years, for several different reasons. One reason was that at that point, radio stations weren't playing a lot of records. There was a lot of live music on the air, but not a lot of records. And the other reason was that it was just too sensitive to play. Radio was a very uncontroversial medium at that point. Most of the music was, you know, Lucky Strike, Hit Parade, and shows like that. And the Andrews Sisters, I mean, that was the kind of thing that people were doing. And radio had never really heard anything like this before. So it got very little airplay. There were a couple of disc jockeys who made a point to play it. And I interviewed a very interesting fellow named Daddy-O Daly, who was one of the early disc jockeys in Chicago. And he talks about playing it whenever he could get away with it. You know, you had to submit lists of songs to play. And he would get it on there and try to sneak it by the station brass whenever he could. And he tells the story about how whenever there was a kind of racial episode in Chicago, you know, when a black man ran a red light or something and a cop beat him up, that he would deliberately put the song on the air. The song became a sort of all-purpose protest weapon for him, and he would play it just to remind people of the kinds of things that went on in America at that point.
Now, I think of Billie Holiday as being the singer that owns Strange Fruit, but it's a song that was also very much associated with Josh White's career. How did he start singing the song? And he's much more of a folk singer.
Yeah, I think he must have, I mean, he must have heard Billie Holiday sing it, because he didn't start singing it until a few years after she did. And he was appearing at Cafe Society, too. I think he started appearing there in 1944. And I think the song must have grabbed him, and he started to do it. And Billie Holiday was very proprietary about it. And the story is told that Holiday came into his dressing room one night, and there are different versions of this story, again, alluded to in the book, about whether or not she was carrying a knife with her, but threatened him and menaced him and said, "Stop doing that song." And he pleaded with her and said, "Billie, we should both be doing this song until no one has to sing it again." And from that moment on, I guess they reached some kind of agreement, and he continued to perform it. And as I say, I think, you know, in terms of the number of people who heard the song in performance, probably more people heard him than her, because his career lasted a lot longer. He performed before a lot more people. And so he did, in a sense, he did as much to popularize the song as she. Although, to my mind, her version is vastly superior.
Why don't we hear Josh White's reading of Strange Fruit?
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black body swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Oh.
That's Josh White's recording of Strange Fruit. We'll talk more with David Margalek about his new book, Strange Fruit, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Margalek, author of Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday, Cafe Society, and An Early Cry for Civil Rights. How did Strange Fruit change the life of its composer, Abel Meeropol?
Well, I think that I'm not sure if it changed his life at all. It was the composition that he was the proudest of. It was really his most famous composition. The other song that he wrote that people will remember was "The House I Live In," which is which Frank Sinatra sang in 1945 in an Academy Award-winning short subject, sort of a plea for tolerance. And it's a lovely song, and still you still hear it every once in a while. Frank Sinatra did it at the bicentennial celebration, for instance.
We should mention Meeropol wrote the lyric for that, and Earl Robinson
wrote the lyric, and Earl Robinson, who wrote many other famous songs, did the music for it.
Do you have any idea of whether Billie Holiday loved the song or whether she sang it because she felt it was expected of her? I mean, it is so out of character for her to sing, you know, a protest song, and a song where the lyric has such dramatic import, as opposed to, you know, a wonderful love song about falling in love or out of love, which is what, you know, pop songs typically are. And I say that really believing there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's a fine thing. It's a fine thing for music to be about.
You know, the more research that I did for the book, the more ambiguous the answer to your question becomes. I think she had very mixed feelings about the song. I think that, again, she adopted it and it spoke to her and she liked to perform it under the right circumstances. I think that she resented being asked to do it all the time. She didn't, you know, there were often times when she didn't want to do it. There's even evidence that she felt sort of a little bit imprisoned by the song. When I interviewed Bill Dufty for the book, he even mentioned that he felt that one of the reasons that she gave Abel Meeropol short shrift was that she sort of resented that this song had become part of her life and sort of become a metaphor for her life. I think she had very, very mixed, very torn feelings about the song, but she performed it right up until the end.
I wonder how she felt, too, that at least at the beginning of the song's life, it was probably primarily white audiences that really wanted her to sing it.
Yeah, I think that was undoubtedly part of the mix, her mixed feelings about it. But I think it was a song principally for white radicals at the beginning. And as I said, one of the interesting things in the evolution of the song is I think that the black community came to it much later and adopted it much later, and it became sort of an anthem there later than it did in the white radical community.
What are some of the interesting developments in the life of Strange Fruit now?
Well, there are various things. I mean, for one thing, it's been adopted by the gay community. There's a story in the book about Strange Fruit having been included in a show in San Francisco, with its lyrics having been changed and the controversy over that.
How were the lyrics changed?
Well, the lyrics were changed to talk about strange fruit as strange gays, you know, to deliberately play on the word fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It's applied to strange fruits in the gay community, the idea that more flamboyant gays are discriminated against by straighter, more subdued ones. And this was included in this review in San Francisco, where it turned out that the gay community was divided about the song. Some of them felt that it was perfectly appropriate to adapt it to their particular situation, whereas others felt that this was Billie Holiday's and this was the black community's song, and it shouldn't be mucked around with. I mean, that's one interesting sort of contemporary use of the song.
Well, David Margalef, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Margalef is the author of the new book, Strange Fruit. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Billie Holiday's 1945 Jazz at the Philharmonic recording of Strange Fruit.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And now I'd like to sing a tune. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. I do hope you like it. Ah.
trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.